Pam Grout, a freelance writer, a travel columnist, an adventure extraordinaire, has written many, many books, over 15 books. But today, we're going to focus this adventure extraordinaire on jumpstart your metabolism, how to lose weight by changing the way you breathe, burn calories more efficiently, increase your energy, reduce stress and anxiety. I'm delighted to bring Pam here today because I tried taking yoga and I couldn't get breathing properly through yoga. So maybe you can elucidate in some of these incredible cocktails you offer the public how to breathe properly. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Pam Grout. Welcome to It's Rainmaking Time.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
The first thing I want to take care of is the fact that most of the way in which we breathe is not processed properly. Could you explain a little bit about respiration? First of all, why did you write this book?
Well, I had taken a breathing training and was just blown away by the powerful effects of what breathing can do. And after I'd had my daughter, I, like many people, had a few extra pounds to lose. And I read this book by Tony Robbins, or I heard a tape by Tony Robbins, I guess it was, and he talked about how he had lost weight using breathing, and I had studied breathing and had known a lot of people that had lost weight, but they didn't put two and two together. They didn't really realize, wow, this is why I lost weight. And then I started doing some research and finding out the reason I had done the breathing technique was a rebirthing process. It was a whole different thing. But in the process, all these people were losing weight, but again, they weren't trying to. And then here I lost this weight, and it's like, wow, this is amazing. And so I started doing research, and it turns out it's really connected. And in fact, the reason when people go exercise and they lose weight, I mean, nobody really knows why do they lose weight, but they're actually putting all this extra oxygen in their body, and that helps them lose weight because it's like stoking a fire. You know, if you try to start a fire and it doesn't have any oxygen, it can't really burn. So our metabolism is very closely tied into how much oxygen it gets. In fact, metabolism just means how well does your body work. And when you have more oxygen, your body is able to work better.
I was very excited to hear that 70% of wastes are processed through the breath. Now, I would imagine that the average public, even very informed public person, thinks that most of the waste is not processed through the breath.
Well, you know, we don't even really think about waste that much because our bodies are such amazing machines. I mean, they just, you know, can do all this stuff. So we don't really have to think about it too much. It just kind of happens. But obviously, we're taking in food, our body's processing, but there is a lot of waste. And because it does, but most of it comes out through our breath. And in fact, if we want to really have our bodies working properly, and if we are breathing properly, our bodies have less toxicity to have to deal with.
Is that proven?
By breathing better, you know, we actually help our body, you know, do all the things that it has to do.
But is that actually a known fact? Is it an opinion or is it a scientific fact?
No, it is a scientific fact. But it is, I think most people don't know it. I mean, I think what happens is when things are just normal and natural, I mean, you don't have to think to breathe. I mean, your body, if you try to hold your breath, eventually your body will take over and take a deep breath. Remember when you're a little kid and you said, hey, Mom, I'm not going to breathe. And eventually, you know, your body just takes over. And I think things like that that just happen naturally and normally, we just take them for granted and we don't really think about them. I mean, it's like we don't have to think about them. So basically, I think most people just, you know, take it for granted and they don't realize how important it is and how much power it has and who thinks about waste. I mean, you know, we don't think about the waste that we, you know, put out on our trash once, you know, they come and pick it up. And we certainly don't think about the waste in our body. I mean, it's just not something people think about. We're so obsessed with what are we taking in. I mean, it's like, oh, let's count these calories. Let's count these fat grams. I mean, we're thinking about all this kind of stuff. And nobody has bothered to mention, hey, how does the body process this stuff? And how can we make the body process it better? So it's this huge piece. It's like the important piece, and nobody bothered to bring it up, you know? So it's like we're focusing on the wrong thing.
And we certainly hear a lot about, you know, cleansing and taking colonics, but we don't hear about the day-to-day maintenance.
Right, that's true. There is now a little bit of, you know, people are more interested in the colonics and that kind of thing. And that is, that's a good thing to do too. But here's something that you're doing every day. I mean, your body's doing this anyway every single day. So by learning to breathe better, you can actually, improve how your body's working. So here's something that is so powerful, it's so natural, and we don't even think about it.
I noticed that in your book, you say we breathe at 1/5 the capacity that's available. Can you explain that?
Of our lungs, yeah. I mean, most people take really wimpy breaths. They breathe into their chest. I mean, our lungs are capable of taking in this set amount of oxygen, and most of us take in, like I said, about 1/5 of what we're capable of taking in. And as I like to say, you know, if you were getting 1/5 of the sleep you needed, or if you were getting 1/5 of the food you needed, you would not feel very good. So here we are, you know, most of us are getting 1/5 of the oxygen that we're capable of taking in. And it's no wonder our bodies are sluggish and aren't working as well. We don't have energy and all these things. In fact, there are many doctors that are really aware of breathing. And there's some that have, in fact, there's a doctor, I believe his last name is Hendler, and he says the first thing he prescribes, it doesn't matter what people come in for him for, the first thing he prescribes is taking deeper breaths. And of course, Andrew, was it Weil, that
yeah.
doctor, yeah, he's really big on breathing too. And it's like before, you know, before you try to, you know, fix anything else, first you need to fix your breathing and how you're breathing. And once you do that, then you can deal with some other things. But a lot of times, simple act of getting more oxygen, getting more fuel that, you know, makes your body work can solve a lot of other problems.
What actually is happening in breathing? I know you explained a part of it. It's like stoking a fire with oxygen, but you release carbon dioxide. Could you share with the listener, like, what is actually happening when you're taking these deep breaths? I notice you have also like 15 different cocktails or exercises people can do. Is it 15 minutes a day or?
Well, I don't even say a particular time frame. The eventual goal is to get to where every breath is deeper and fuller, but if you practice these, it gets you more in touch with your breath. So these are exercises people can do. And the one that I did, the very first one, the one I call the Baywatch Bikini Breath, that is the one that I did and that I suddenly lost, wow, 10 pounds. That made me start, you know, this whole investigation thinking, wow, that was really odd. How did this happen? And I started doing all the research. But what happens is, okay, your body, you know, has to process a lot of things, and it has carbon dioxide that has to come out. And the best way to get it out, or it comes out anyway, through your breathing. But if you breathe better, and if you learn to breathe better, you can actually get rid of more of it easier than if you just kind of take these little wimpy breaths. In fact, the exhale is just as important as the inhale. I mean, you want to get lots of oxygen in. You want to, well, in the Baywatch Bikini Breath, you leave it in your body for a while so it can kind of cleanse it, and then you breathe it out. And you try to push every last bit of it out, you know, for two reasons. One, it gets rid of that waste you're talking about. And secondly, it opens the capacity to take in the next breath deeper and fuller. So that's, you know, that's like the key, the cornerstone breath, you know, around which all the rest of it revolves. But the other ones are good as well to get in touch with your breath and to, you know, just be more in touch with what your body's needing and what your body can do.
One of the things I really loved about your book is that it takes something that appears to be esoteric, because we don't think about our breathing unless we have trouble breathing. It's
exactly.
Kind of like it just goes on automatically. So therefore, it's not in consciousness. There's no focus on it until you have a problem. Then there's or a disease or some type of ailment. I thought it was interesting. You said on page 79, as many as 700 billion cells are replaced each day with new ones. And the old cells are toxic and must be removed from the system. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well, they say that, you know, our body is completely different. It completely changes itself. And, oh, Deepak Chopra talked about this. I can't remember how long it is, but, you know, like you have a new liver than you had, you know, 5 months ago. And so your cells are constantly replenishing, constantly. In fact, there was a guy who won the Nobel Prize back in the 30s who, you know, did an experiment with cells, and he said, really, there's no reason we even need to age. I mean, as far as, you know, cells completely replenish themselves, but we've done so many things to our body and partly even our beliefs and things, so we've gotten to where we're not, you know, turning them over and we're replacing them like they were before when they actually could come back new and fresh and clean. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting research and a lot we still have to learn about this.
You put a lot in context. You said also breathing and metabolism are inseparable, and oxygen is the key, will always be the key that unlocks your metabolic rate. You also go on to say for every 4.8 calories, the average person's body burns 1 liter of oxygen. In other words, your metabolism is nothing but a measure of how much oxygen you burn. Fascinating.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then you talk about a set point. Can you talk a little bit about that, how you can get a new set point?
Well, this is something a lot of people have talked about. Oh, I have this metabolic set point and there's nothing I can do. I mean, everybody thinks, oh, you know, you can go on the big diet, you can lose the weight, but then eventually your body's going to get back to that, what they call set point, that metabolic set point. Well, that is basically just a bad habit or a rut that you're in. And by learning to breathe better, by doing some of these exercises, and if you really, really focus on your breath, I mean, there's so much the breath has to teach you. But anyway, you can change your set point. I mean, there's nothing static. I mean, we're constantly moving, you know, these rivers of energy, and people think it's just the same static body, but it's not. It's constantly changing. So the set point certainly tends to stay the same, but it's basically a rut, and it can be changed.
I had the pleasure of studying with Thich Nhat Hanh.
That's great.
In Los Angeles, actually in Escondido in 2001. And then I did a workshop with him and then later interviewed Sister Chan Kong just after a couple of years after 9/11 in 2004 when she was in France. And he says, and you've quoted him, breath is aligned to both body and mind, and it alone can bring them together. And it's a constant focus in Thich Nhat Hanh's work and contribution, breathing in, breathing out, and slowing down and taking in more oxygen. So I thought it was an interesting correlation.
Yeah, well, I think the breath is that bridge between the body and the mind. And we tend to separate them. You know, we're so much in our minds. I think people tend to stay in their heads. And the breath is the way to connect you to your body and connect you to your spirit, you know, that deeper, you know, more holy place. And I think, when people get stressed, they start breathing really fast. I mean, you can tell actors when they want to, you know, replicate a particular mood, they alter their breathing, because breathing, you know, people in stress states breathe fast. People that are relaxed, you hang around with the Dalai Lama and he takes deep breaths. I'm sure Thich Nhat Hanh does as well. So it really is that it's like the open door that you can get to, you know, to access some of these things that we've been trying to access for a long time. So breath is so important. I mean, it's the key.
What do you think about people with asthma?
Well, I think they could certainly benefit from doing some of these breathing exercises. They definitely aren't taking in as much oxygen. And I haven't studied asthma. I don't know as much about it as a doctor, of course. But I do know that by taking in deeper breaths and by doing some of that, they can, you know, help their asthma. I think their asthma can be aided with besides, I mean, of course, you know, they have all the little machines and all that kind of stuff, but I think some of these exercises can also help them. I think there's other ways to improve their condition.
I noticed you said something kind of unusual too about that diets don't work. For most of the public, they don't.
They absolutely don't. And the thing that's so funny about it, we spend billions of dollars every year continuing to diet. We do one diet after another, after another, after another. I mean, look at Oprah, who's, you know, the classic case of the person. I mean, she'll, you know, do the various diets and it will come back. They just don't work. You have to change your mind. You have to change the way your body processes. Certainly good eating habits are important, but a diet is a deprivation, and anything that's deprivation is not going to be healthy. I mean, I guess when you talk about a diet, meaning what you're taking in, I mean, a good diet is certainly important, but dieting the way we think of it as, oh, okay, I can only have this today or I can only have that, I mean, you're going to rebel. Your body's going to rebel. And why, instead of focusing again on what's coming in, why don't you focus on, you know, how to make the body work better and how to process what you do take in? There's just better ways to do it. And diets don't work, and it's ironic that we keep going on diets.
Are you a breathing coach?
I am a breathing coach. I actually studied to be a breathing coach. I am trained to do it. I don't focus on that as much. I ended up taking the writing part of my interest, and I focus more on my writing. I mean, that's kind of how I make my living as a writer. But I am trained to be a breathing coach and occasionally do have breathing clients.
And you see them in person? And obviously,
yeah, they come in. It's a one-on-one kind of thing. So, yes, I certainly have done that. And you know, do that from occasion, but I don't focus on that. It's, again, I became a writer more than a breathing coach.
I would imagine with today's technology, if people really wanted to have some breathing sessions from you, even though writing is your main focus, they could probably go on Skype or on iChat and learn from you, actually online.
In fact, I used to give a lot. When this book first came out, I used to give seminars and things and did a lot more, you know, just to big groups. But I usually work one-on-one. When I, as a breathing coach, the way I've done it is one-on-one with people. The speaking about breathing, again, that when that book came out, I did go around and speak quite a bit to groups. And that's basically sharing some of the things that are in the book and you know, teaching people how to do the exercises and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I suppose I could do that for someone on Skype if they were interested.
Why do you feel it is that most of us are not aware that we're holding our breath a lot? I do it a lot, and I don't even know I'm doing it. It's frightening.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's just patterns that we've gotten into. I think when we're afraid, we get hurt, you know, as a little kid, as different things, and then our bodies get into patterns of holding our breath. It's kind of the old fight or flight example. You know, your body says, oh, it's just a reaction. And I think rather than taking the time to calm down and take the deep breath, we tend to flee. And I think our bodies are just stuck in some old patterns. So I believe that's why we tend to hold our breath. There's a lot of reasons why we got into those patterns, but it's just amazing how, but it's easy to change a pattern. That's what's important. I wouldn't say it's easy. It's certainly doable, but it takes discipline to change a pattern. And that's really what's important, is to try to change patterns. I mean, we get locked into certain ways of doing things, but we can change them with making it important, you know, making it as a priority.
The thing I liked a lot of things about your book. I was so shocked. I was like, oh my God, jumpstart your metabolism, because it's a big deal when you're carrying too much weight. And as you get older, people tend to accumulate rather than lose extra fat. So it seemed like you were offering a different paradigm, first of all, and then tools and exercises to deal with that paradigm. And like you said at the beginning of our broadcast, people think about, you know, altering what comes in, but not shifting the way it comes out. And I paraphrased it, but I think it's very interesting that we don't think of waste as being processed by respiration.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very key frame of reference to understanding what goes on. Like, it's a missing point in consciousness that breathing is not only directly related to oxygenation, but processing waste that's being accumulated on a high degree that has outside of anything related to the colon.
Right.
You know, very exactly. Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's, you know, if your car's not working, you don't keep trying to change the gas you're putting into it. You know, you get the internal workings to work again, and it's the same thing. But we've just completely missed this piece of it. We don't even think about that, which is just a big irony. I mean, why is that not, why doesn't everybody know this? I don't know. They should.
You quoted some very interesting people. Tom Good, the managing director of the International Breath Institute, said that 90% of the American population exhibits restricted breathing patterns.
Yeah, yeah.
That's huge.
It's huge. Almost everybody does.
Wow. And then you also quoted Sheldon Saul Hendler, Dr.
Mm-hmm,
Hendler,
mm-hmm.
on the oxygen breakthrough.
Right. He's the doctor I mentioned early that prescribes breathing first for all of his patients. I mean, that's like, okay, you know, you got to get this part right before, you know, we can even look at anything else. So yeah, he's very much into breathing.
That's a whole different protocol almost. It's a whole different paradigm of thinking to start mm-hmm. with breath first.
Mm-hmm.
How long did it take you to write this book from research to delivery? Do you remember?
You know, probably a year, I would say. The actual writing took less, but, you know, all the research and everything, I would say roughly a year, maybe a little bit less.
Have people called you and sent you emails about starting breathing cocktails and their weight popping off?
When the book first came out, I would get stories all the time. When the book first came out, there was, not everybody was doing email, but I would, you know, I got letters. I had in the first book, I self-published this book at first, and I had a post office box, and I had little pamphlets you could get, you know, to continue, I mean, with more specific things. And so I heard from so many people, you know, that wrote to me in my post office box. But now, you know, that I do have email, yes, I still do hear from people. It's just that it's not, you know, on the bookshelf now. I mean, you have to actually know about this book and you have to ask for it at your bookstore, because most bookstores don't have it, because, I don't know, books are funny. They have their 3-month window of opportunity when they're in the bookstores, and then the new ones come out or whatever. But this book has done really well. I mean, a lot of people have read it. But yeah, no, I still hear from people constantly telling me either their success stories or asking me specific questions about, hey, what about when I breathe this way? So, yeah, no, I hear from people quite a bit. And in fact, I kind of forgot what exactly you asked. Something about people contacting me.
Right. I would imagine that stories are coming in, success stories, about people utilizing the cocktails you give for breathing in your book.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be fascinated, interested to hear people's stories. I hope maybe you'll open up your site regarding that book, or maybe open up another site of let people share their stories, because that's really like manifest reality. Not only is the evidence you're pointing out on a scientific level with regard to breathing, but there's something about hearing people's success stories and actually using what you're providing, and it's working, I think would be very inspiring to people around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good point. That is a good point. Some of the stories I've heard have even amazed me. Like, I had one woman, I mean, this almost even seems impossible, tell me that she lost 20 pounds in 2 weeks, which I found, I mean, either she had really poor breathing habits, but you know, I mean, that's like the most extreme one. More typical would be like 10 pounds in about a month, that kind of thing. But no, I hear these kind of stories. Yeah, people, I mean, because people get excited when something like this works. And so, you know, I do hear a lot of stories like that. And that is a good idea to put up a website about that.
I think it would be very, very important for people to hear, what do people do, you know, how long they did it, whatever, what cocktails they used, blah, blah. Just because this is a mysterious paradigm for the average person. I mean, we all know breathing is important and central to being alive, but we do not consider on a paradigm level breathing essential for energy metabolism, for, you know, respiration and weight loss. So I think that there's something to be said there. Tell us a little bit about your work in writing, and also your, a little bit about your other books and your work as an adventurer and travel columnist.
Oh, well, I've always been a traveler. My dad was a Methodist minister, and he used to load us in the family station wagon when I was a kid, and we'd travel around the country. So I got a taste for travel at a pretty young age. But then as I got older and started, you know, doing writing, I, as a person who likes to write, would go somewhere and then would write about it. Didn't even know there was such a thing as travel writing, but, you know, just little by little, people would say, hey, would you like to write a travel article about this or that? I mean, so then it became, you know, a passion of mine, where I attempted to travel as much as possible and to write about it. The most recent books I have done have been for National Geographic, and they've been books about meaningful vacations. And there are things like silent retreats, volunteer vacations, like maybe going to a monastery in Mongolia, for example, and helping them restore it. So in fact, the last book was just about volunteer vacations. The other two before that were about like arts and crafts vacations. You can go to Laos, for example, and work with Laos potters to learn how to do pottery.
Wow.
You can go to, you know, the first one was basically just in North America, but there, you know, there were the four categories: volunteer, arts and crafts, learning vacations, or what I call brain retreats, you know, where you go and actually learn a new craft, or, you know, like learning how to do architecture. There's a thing up at the Frank Lloyd Wright up in Chicago. So anyway, just a real variety of adventures that you can do. And then right now, I have a passion for travel and also inspiration. And I think the breathing, of course, falls in under the inspiration. But right now I'm doing an iPhone app, which is, it's called A D to Day, and it's 365 ways to spread the love, and it's just all kinds of different things people can do. In fact, I'm supposedly finishing it today to go to the, I don't know if you call them publishers when they're iPhone apps, but the company that's, you know, doing the actual technical part of, you know, making it ready for the iPhone. It goes to them today. But it's, you know, just a way to try to change the world, you know, one little steps at a time, little things that we can all do. I mean, every decision we make, you know, puts us one way or the other, you know, and we want to make our world a better place. So, you know, these are just little things people can do. So I guess, you know, the breathing is super important, and I love it. It's just that I've kind of moved on to other things. Not that I don't practice it, not that I don't love it. I just am not focusing on that. I'm focusing on some of these other
projects. It's like having had many creative children.
Yes.
They're all competing for your attention.
They are, yeah.
I noticed you have a book called God Doesn't Have Bad Hair Days. That looks adorable.
Oh, I love that book. It's actually experiments people can do to... Now, when I say God, I mean more like spirit. And I called it God because that's how a lot of people... But I think the word God has a lot of baggage.
It's a darling title still.
Yeah, it is. It was a cute title. It is a cute title. But it's talking more about, you know, that spiritual component of us. And it's experiments you can do literally to see, does this work? Because, you know, it's always so vague, you know, oh, God, what is it? It's just this vague thing. And here's 10 concrete things that people can do. Things from, you know, testing to see if you're really energy to asking for specific things and being real specific, saying, hey, I mean, you don't call up Sears and say, hey, send me something I like. You say, hey, this is what I want. I want the blow dryer on page 5 or whatever, you know, with the old Sears catalog or whatever. So it's, you know, learning to be specific in what you're asking from spirit. And so basically it's 10 experiments that people do. And talk about hearing from people. I heard, you know, from lots of people about the amazing things that they've gotten by doing these experiments. So anyway, that's what God Doesn't Have Bad Hair Days about. It's a wonderful book, and I love it, and anyway, it's out there too. It's very much reminiscent of The Secret. I mean, it's kind of that type of idea about what we focus on expands in our life.
But you know what I love about your work, and I haven't read God Doesn't Have Bad Hair Days yet. Hopefully your publishers will send me some of these and I'll read them, and maybe
I'm having the hardest time getting my publishers to
where is the publishers when you need them.
Yeah.
I love the lightness and levity and the creative spirit, the way in which, you know, a lot of these titles, you can feel the energy of these books, Living Big, Girlfriend Getaways, Recycle This Book. That sounds funny. The 100 Best Worldwide Vacations to Enrich Your Life. I mean, you know, and it goes on. You Know You're in Kansas When, Art and Soul, Kansas Curiosities. I mean, you seem like you're having a great time with your life.
Yeah, you know, one agent told me one time, she said, you know, most people do focus on a particular topic and stick with it, like they become an expert in a particular topic, but I'm kind of like that traditional jack-of-all-trades, master-of-none person. I suppose breathing would be the one area that I probably, well, I am trained. I did a six-month training, so I am trained in that, but I do tend to dabble. I guess I'm a dabbler in a lot of different things.
Well, that's good. That means you're a curious student.
Yes. It's whatever catches my interest, and then I work on that for a while. But that's one of the gifts of being a freelance writer, is that you can choose what interests you. I mean, I mentioned to you, I also created a TV series about it's in an eco village. It's 6 characters in an eco village, and again, it's trying to get out the green idea. You know, there's a lot of things people can do to save the planet, and it's supposed to be a more subtle thing. You know, you can hit them over the head like Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth, which is a great movie. I love that movie, but this is, you know, a little bit more subtle. These characters do things, and then people go, you know, that's a good idea. I should try that. So that's kind of the idea behind that. So yeah, I'm kind of all over the board in my projects and what I'm working on.
That's awesome. What is Living Big about?
It's about the power of one person to make a difference. And I've got stories in there of all these different people who really just one person could do something wonderful. Some person could do something extraordinary. I think it's so easy to think, oh, what do I do? What do I do? But, you know, we all want to make a difference. I mean, really, truly, every one of us, that is what we want more than anything else. You know,
I agree.
We think, oh, we want to get this or get that. But, you know, that's not what we really want. I mean, we're kidding ourselves if we think that's going to bring us happiness. The only thing that really, truly brings us happiness is giving of ourselves to other people. And basically, Living Big is about that. There's again, tools that you can use to live big yourself, but it's a lot of stories. I think a lot of times when you hear about other people doing interesting, inspiring things, then you get interested in inspiring. In fact, sometimes I think that might be the best way to learn and grow is by, you know, being in the energy of inspiring people. In fact, one of the things, I think it was another book I said this, but I said, call the most inspiring person you know and find out what they're doing. You know what I mean?
You're right. You're right. It's totally exciting. It's riveting. It's also catchy.
Yeah. Well, rather than just, you know, you can, oh, okay, here's your five lists for doing this. Well, those get old and boring. Not that they don't have a place, but in some ways I think if you can catch the energy of someone that is doing interesting, amazing things, that might be the best way to, you know, to inspire yourself.
That's awesome. And what about girlfriend getaways? That sounds like a riot.
Yeah, there's a trend in the travel business, and it may be not as big as it was, but when this book came out, hotels, resorts, everybody was saying, hey, you know, women have money and women like to travel together. You know, their husband doesn't want to go with them to whatever it is they're doing. So basically, there's 8 different types of getaways. I believe it's 8, like shopping getaways, spa getaways, spiritual getaways. So it's just ideas for things girlfriends can do together on vacations and different packages that they can take. And from a person who's done a lot of girlfriend getaways, I can, in fact, one of the lines I say in there is, you know, fire your therapist and go on a girlfriend getaway. Because you do all the same things. You know, you talk about all your issues, you have a good time, and you look at things from a different perspective. You know, you get into a rut in your life and you think, So anyway, it's just a way of stepping out of the rut, and a vacation's a great way to do that. So basically, it's just a way to, you know, brighten your life, I guess.
There's also something very interesting. I traveled when I was 21, and my first trip out of the United States was to India. And I'd never traveled outside of the U.S.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, I got arrested at the Taj Mahal.
Oh,
but,
no.
Yeah, but it's actually a very funny story. I got arrested at the Taj Mahal. And what happened is I went in, and then, of course, there's the king's tomb, right?
Uh-huh.
So there was a little fire there. There was a little candle. And I walked in, and I had a money belt on, and I took one of the rupees, and I put it down near the candle because people had left rupees near this candle. So I went back, and I was touching the wall and looking at the wall, and all of a sudden, these two guys come up to me, "Madam, come with us." And I was like, "What? You're under arrest." I said, "What?" And they said, "Counterfeit, counterfeit, counterfeit.
Oh,
please
my.
Give us your passport." And of course, you know, I was really young, and I didn't know what the heck they were talking about. So I said, "What are you talking about?" And they said, "What is this?" And they present this bill to me. It was a rupee. And I said, "What is what?" He goes, "What is this?" I said, "It's a rupee." "No, it's counterfeit." And he turns it around, and it's a flying bird on the other side of a rupee. Well, apparently, the rickshaw driver in that morning at 4 in the morning that took me to the Taj Mahal had given me a counterfeit bill. Who knew?
Oh, wow.
I didn't see it because all I saw on top was the rupee, the front side. I didn't look at the back side. And who looks at the front and back sides of currency?
Wow. How interesting.
So it was the tour guide that saved me.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, people were like, they handcuffed me. I thought, you know what? I'm Jewish and I'm female. I'm sitting in the Taj Mahal. I'm getting arrested and I'm 19 years old. And I tipped the dead guy. What the heck? You know?
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, so it was one of those inspirations. I have many wild stories in India, and I've traveled to Europe and other places. But one of the things I love about your work is the also advocating of travel for inspiration and education and learning and transformation, but also for kids. Travel is incredible for kids.
Yeah, my daughter, she's 16 now, and she loves to travel. I mean, she, you know, at her young age has already written 3 travel columns, which, of course, is pretty amazing. She's been paid $75 for each one of them. You know, for a kid her age, that's a pretty big deal.
That's incredible.
You have to work a lot of hours at Dairy Queen to make that kind of money. And plus, she just loves to travel. And now she's really getting into this travel for good. I mean, she's really eager to, you know, do more volunteer vacations and that kind of thing. She just really enjoys that. She's in a social awareness club at school. And
really?
Yeah, so she's learning all kinds of things like that and really into it. So I'm real proud of her. She's quite a kid.
Wow, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Don't you think that there are some, given what's happening to youth today in terms of the quickening and the expediting of the electronic age, because kids are connected to iPhones and cell phones and the internet and everything is electronic, don't you think that the travel arena is even going to be more impactful because everybody's so over-connected to electronics?
Yeah, I do think that's true. I'm a little concerned with it, actually. I worry. But, you know, that's probably typical. The old generation worries about the new generation. You know, they're too connected to the screen and to all that.
Well,
kind of
I'm worried,
stuff.
Too. I find that our youth has been hijacked, actually.
I am concerned about that. But, you know, you have to just continue to believe in the best, and that, because there's so much good from all the connection
that's
as well.
True.
You know,
that's true.
There's the... You know, I mean, so it just depends on what you want to focus on. Sometimes I do focus on the worry, like, oh, they're just too into the screen thing. But you know, there's so many positives to focus on, so I guess I just keep making that decision to, you know, to focus on that.
I think ultimately it's all how the kids are trained and brought up, because if they're brought up seeking positive energy and life-giving conversation and discovery, they're going to find it on the internet. And if they're brought up in a negative, you know, lower vibrational focus, that's where they're going to go.
Exactly. Too. Yeah. I mean, you always, you know, find that what you look for. I mean, that's exactly, you know, what life is about. It's, you know, you find what you expect, what you want, even, is what you get. I mean, it's kind of scary to think, wow, did I want that? But that's what I believe, is that, you know, we do. Because the truth is, there's so much, every possibility is ours, but we, you know, get cemented into a small possibility. And I think, you know, that's what happens. We think that's what reality is. Well, it's not. That's just our making of, you know, shrinking down all the possibilities into a little box. So we all live in these little boxes.
Are you doing a lot of self-publishing now? Because it sounds like you can come up with books very quickly.
Well, no. I self-published Jumpstart first, and then, you know, Simon & Schuster bought it, Fireside for Simon & Schuster. I self-published the Recycle This book because it's done on grocery bags, recycled grocery bags. So when I say recycle it, I mean, I'm really serious.
Wow.
Although a better way to recycle it is to give it to someone else so then they can read the tips as well. But no, I haven't self-published other than those two books. I started a little Patootie Press, and I did both of those books with Patootie Press. But mostly I... you know, sell to publishers. Although, you know, the publishing industry is changing, and I
totally,
may possibly get into doing some self-publishing. I don't know. I'm kind of open to new ideas and new avenues and kind of exploring some new things. So we'll see what happens next.
I think the nice thing about self-publishing is that you can reduce the cost of bringing a book to market and to make it available, and you can seed the book. You can actually put it into consciousness and allow consciousness to move it. Without having to do huge, big runs.
Right,
and
right.
Very, very expensive runs. And then the other thing is the publisher has a new role to play that publishers typically didn't think about before, which is that people can now name their own books, test their own books, dress their own books, and have their own editors. It doesn't take that long. Once you have your content, to organize it and put it together.
Mm-hmm.
And the speed to market, that whole paradigm has changed.
Yeah, well, part of the reason with this Recycle book, I mean, I wanted to have it come out at Earth Day. And I think I came up with it in February. Of course, Earth Day's in April. So there's no way. I mean, it might have come out Earth Day the following year if I'd have gone with a publisher. But because I wanted this unusual thing, you know, publishing it on the grocery bags, you know, I just did it myself. It was like, okay, if you want to get this done, you better do it. So I did. And it was mostly a local production. I mean, I got some mention in a Canadian magazine, and it's a wonderful book. But it, you know, I self-published them all. I mean, I even printed them all myself. So I didn't do a huge run or anything. But I had fun with it. I got a lot of publicity.
You know what's interesting about self-publishing, too? I just want to add that years ago, if you self-published, there was a stigma to you and your book. In other words, it meant you were rejected from, quote, real authority-like publishers. And there was a stigma attached to it. Not today. If you're an author and you got something to say and you got something you consider important and you're passionate about, you're an author and you can publish immediately. And you don't need a publisher to validate your contribution and your offering. It's also true with radio and television content now. The entire paradigm for communication is different. And it used to be, even in as late as 2004, when I went off traditional radio and I took the show to the internet, it was like, there wasn't the same attention. Literally in 6 years, almost 6 years, the internet is where the action is. Mm-hmm. And the radio and television is ancillary. So there's been an entire flip of focus and attention. So that which is coming onto the internet is considered real, is considered viable, is considered of importance. And people now who have something to provide and to offer no longer have to think that they don't have the credibility or they're marginalized or their work is peripheralized. It's now a center point. And that's a huge distinction in being able to bring contributions and works that have to do with content to the market.
Right. Yeah, I even heard J.J. Abrams, who's like the producer of Lost and, you know, several huge shows and movies and whatnot. I think he did the Star Trek thing this summer. But anyway, he said that, now you can buy a camera, a video camera, that's about the same quality as the ones that they use, you know, in these million-dollar productions. And he said everybody should be out there making movies, you know. It doesn't just have to be, you know, the people that, you know, get the attention of the Hollywood, you know,
absolutely,
bigwigs or whatever, that anybody can do it, and we should be doing it. You know, it's a democracy out there. So anyway.
And I also think creative works will find their level, will seek their level.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly if you're passionate about it and excited about it, and you can maintain that passion and excitement, because people start out excited, and then the business of bringing it to market kills their spirit a lot of times. Mm-hmm. Or they get discouraged. So if you can maintain it, it's easier to bring through. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about regarding Jumpstart, your metabolism, or anything you feel is left unsaid to the public, or any parts of that book that you'd like to say, or anything else related to?
Well, the one thing I always like to say when it comes to anything that's considered self-help, which in a way this is, it's a way of, but that eventually, or, you know, it's good to know this information about breathing, but I do believe that all of us have within ourselves these amazing answers, and that the breath itself can teach you anything you need to know to lose weight, to do, you know, whatever it is you need to do. So, you know, I certainly encourage people to read the book and to look at it, but I also encourage them to, you know, really seek within to find some of these answers and to trust that it's there. It really is there, you know, if they just believe that and go for it. And belief is really important, having the faith and knowing that, you know, what you believe, what you think is going to happen. That's a really important tool as well.
You talked about practicing 15 minutes of this deep breathing a day.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that if it were trialed for 21 days, that something extraordinary would happen. What made you pick 15 minutes a day and for 21 days?
Well, 15 minutes is pretty easy. I mean, that's not a huge commitment. You know, I think even if you go jog or take up a, you know, most exercise programs, at least 30 minutes. So it's 15 minutes. So it's doable. It's easy. And 21 days, I've heard, is the time it takes to change a pattern. And again, this is all about changing paradigms, changing patterns. And so I think 21 days, if you can stick with it for 21 days, you can, you'll see amazing results. And at that time, you know, after you've done it for, it's like, wow, you'll your own motivation, your own inertia will keep you going. And I mean inertia in the moving inertia, not the sitting and not doing anything inertia, you know, that then it will take over of its own course. It will begin rolling on its own. So 21 days is just a good thing to get the commitments, you know, solidified in. And 15 minutes, because it's pretty easy, and that's enough time to, you know, you can actually learn quite a bit in 15 minutes.
Is it possible to do it twice a day for 15 minutes?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, the more you do it, the more. I mean, some people like to do it all the time. You know, again, the ideal is that you'll learn enough about breathing, you'll become much more conscious of every breath. And not so much where you have to sit around and think, oh, how am I breathing at every moment, but you just will notice when you're not breathing as fully and deeply as you want. It'll just become to your awareness, and then you'll quickly correct that if that's what you choose to do. But you'll just be aware of it. You'll just realize, wow, you know, I'm not breathing very fully right now. So again, it's a good way to cleanse your body. It's a good way to, in fact, I recommend doing the Baywatch Bikini Breath, the 10 breaths. I recommend doing that three times a day. And that doesn't take, well, I don't know, it might take 10 minutes depending on, you know, how much, you know, oxygen you can take in. But it's a pretty simple thing. I mean, you can do it while you're driving to work. You can do it while you're sitting in the bathtub. I mean, you know, or while you're watching television. You know, it's so easy. It's so easy. It doesn't cost anything. It's, and it's just a revolutionary thing people can do, and here they don't know about it. It's so funny. The things that are the best and the most potent are often the things we don't know about, I guess.
Isn't that amazing? And it's usually something that's within our access.
It's right there all the time, like that book, Acre of Diamonds. A guy went out looking for diamonds and, you know, spends all of his money, goes around the world a few times, comes back, and they're in his own backyard. There they are. So I kind of like that story. I think that's true for most of us.
Did he write about it?
Yeah, it was a book, famous a long time ago. I think his name was Russell Conway or Conover or something like that. It was called Acres of Diamonds. And I think he was, I mean, he's dead now. This is a long time ago, but it was one of those books that, you know, went around back before the internet.
I noticed that you live in, is it Merriam, Kansas?
Well, I actually live in Lawrence, Kansas now, which is the university town where the University of Kansas is. But at the time I wrote the book, I was in Merriam, which is about 30 minutes away.
Have you lived there your whole life?
I was born in Kentucky, and I've lived in all the states that begin with a C, not because I tried to. It's just I moved to Colorado for the ski season, then I went to California for a while, and then did the breathing training in Connecticut. So it wasn't that I have this weird obsession with states that begin with a C. but anyway, and then I lived in Australia for a year.
You did? Where?
I'm in Sydney.
You did?
Yes, I love that city. It's beautiful.
Would you be willing to name some of your favorite places to travel and maybe even places that you've lived?
Well, you know, people always ask me, oh, what's your favorite place? And the answer I always give, it's where I just last was, because everywhere I go, I think, oh, I want to move there. I love it. I love it so much. But, I love California. I love your area. I mean, it's absolutely gorgeous there. I love Salzburg, Austria a lot. I love New Zealand. I think that's a beautiful country that has, you know, so many things, including a good government that's, you know, very proactive. And Bali is a beautiful place. I don't know. I like, again, I'm just not a good one to name it because I get totally taken by wherever I go. I just came back from Mobile, Alabama, and had such an amazing time, was totally surprised at how progressive it was, really, and how beautiful it was, you know, right there on the Gulf Coast. And you know, stayed in an old historic hotel that's been redone and had just an amazing time. So, you know, I'm the type that could find, you know, beauty and fun wherever I go.
I am too.
Yeah.
When you say you're an adventurist extraordinaire, how do you define that?
Well, I guess I'm mostly talking about the travel and, you know, being willing to try different things. I don't know. I've written articles about some kind of unique things. I'm willing to go try different things. So I think basically having an open mind, and because you can certainly do adventures right in your own backyard, you know, if you have an open mind, you know, spiritually there's all kinds of adventure, right, you know, without moving an inch. So, you know, basically having an open mind, I would say, would be the, adventure extraordinaire. But so, traveling, I guess, is the context in which I wrote that.
So in terms of the most beautiful, breathtaking place you've ever been, can you name three?
Oh, wow.
Awesome that you just have to say them.
Well, Hot Water Beach in New Zealand, it's this place where you could sit on the beach, and then the hot water, you know, it's like a hot springs. You dig your own little hole right there in the beach, and then the hot water comes up, and then you can watch the sunset. I mean, it's absolutely gorgeous on the Coromandel Peninsula of New Zealand. That's really a very special place. I guess I must love ocean. It's ironic I live in Kansas, but I love Big Sur, you know, sitting there in the hot springs at Esalen, you know, watching the whales go by. That's, you know, just an amazing experience. I love the mountains. I love the mountains of Montana. I love the mountains of Colorado. I love, I'm going to New Mexico next month to go skiing down in Taos, which I think is a beautiful area. I love it down there as well. I don't know. I like everywhere, I guess.
Does your husband travel with you?
Actually, I'm not married. I'm a single mom and have been from the beginning.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you travel with your daughter?
Yeah, she's actually a sophomore in high school now, so she's in school and doesn't go as much. But yeah, she loves to travel with me and has certainly traveled a lot with me.
Do you ever lead tours?
No, I've never led a tour, actually. Never have.
Have you ever wanted to?
I've never thought about it. I might be interested in doing it, but no, I hadn't really thought about it.
My questions may get you in trouble. You know
yeah,
what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Do you feel a tour on the approach?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe I do now. The seed has been planted. I don't know.
You know what happens when you talk to another rainmaker, right?
Exactly.
They put a new canvas behind you, and you don't know what happened, but you end up in that canvas.
Yeah. Wait a minute.
You know the access point? It's asking questions.
Yeah. Exactly.
And then presenting landscapes, and all of a sudden, you don't know what happened. You're in them.
Oh, that's great.
Well, I really, really want to thank you for being a guest on It's Rainmaking Time. Ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking with Pam Grout, the author of Jumpstart Your Metabolism, How to Lose Weight, Changing the Way That You Breathe. And it's a way to burn calories more efficiently, increase your energy, and reduce stress and anxiety. She's also the author of so many more books. God Doesn't Have Bad Hair Days, Living Big, Girlfriend Getaways, Recycle This Book, The 100 Best Worldwide Vacations to Enrich Your Life, The 100 Best Volunteer Vacations to Enrich Your Life, The 100 Best Vacations to Enrich Your Life. She also has written Art and Soul, and you know when you're in Kansas, when Kansas Curiosities, Colorado Curiosities, and many more to come. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to It's Rainmaking Time. Pam, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kim.